So, hey everybody, my name is Joe. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. I am also an alcoholic and an addict of many varieties. First thing I want to do is just thank everybody, including the committee, for inviting me, for honoring me. I want to specifically thank Jim S. He's been asking me to this retreat for years, and he finally said, I know a way to get you there, is to nominate you to speak. So I'll thank Jim as well. And you'll know whether to thank him after probably the next hour has passed or not. So I just want to express profound gratitude. Recovery has changed my life in so many different ways. And simultaneously, if I had known what I needed to do to get into recovery the years back that I joined this deal, I probably would have ran screaming from the building. So, it's kind of nice how desperation kind of put me in a place to really be willing and to not worry about what was in front of me and to know that I couldn't turn around. It was kind of like I was in a one-way movement. A few things to start out. There's a couple of kind of things that I've heard along the way that have been really helpful for me. A couple of them are just the humor that comes along with recovery. Probably a couple of my favorite Al-Anon and AA jokes. A woman goes to her doctor and she's coming back to get test results, and the doctor tells her, "I have some really bad news for you. You have 6 months, if you're lucky, to live." And she responds by saying, "How can that be? There must be something I can do. I have to be here. I just can't die. I can't die." He says, "Well, there really isn't anything we can do, but you can marry an alcoholic, and it would feel like a whole lot longer." another kind of. You've heard that already, I apologize, but it's like it's poignant. But the other is there's a group of people standing around a casket, and it's a wake, and they're all standing around and talking about the dearly departed, and remembering him fondly, and then basically saying, how did he die? And one of them says, "The drink took him," and said, "Well, did he ever go to Alcoholics Anonymous?" He said, "Oh no, he wasn't that bad yet." So, it's like, this is the amazing part about what it's like. And I'll tell you what I got in front of me here. These two are the basically the steps, traditions, and concepts of both Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. And the more that I stick around this program, the more that I realize these are the guidelines for my life. These are the way that I can incorporate a solution to anything that comes up in my life. And, I didn't really even know this that as well as I know it today. And I hope, that 29 years from today, I'll know that even deeper if I'm lucky enough to still be alive and sucking air. But I just want to let you know that's kind of what's in front of me. My sobriety date from alcohol and drugs is August 29th, 1986. I went to an Al-Anon meeting probably, I would say, if not within my first year, but kind of right around that time frame. And I went to quite a few Al-Anon meetings. And it was before I had actually settled in with a person who would then become my AA sponsor for the next 24 years. And I was going to the Al-Anon meetings in where I got sober. I got sober in Vail, Colorado, a really small ski town, kind of a small group of people. It's like we were talking to some people around the group this weekend about how good recovery often follows really insane, crazy party towns, and Vail was no exception to that. We had amazing recovery there. while I was going to to Al-Anon, it was recommended to me, and I actually really do. I'm so glad that my sponsor at the time made the recommendation, actually the strong suggestion, to stop going to those Al-Anon meetings until I had worked through my 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I thought that was just unfair and that, you know, she really wasn't understanding me and all of the codependency issues that needed to be addressed in my life, you know. And because I was reading a lot, too much, like not the AA big book. I was reading a lot of other stuff that really was kind of like, for me, a distraction from dealing with my primary issues, which were alcohol and drugs were going to kill me. They were going to take me out quicker. And so, she made that suggestion to me, and I'm grateful for it. And I made it back to Al-Anon probably about, she said, you can go back to Al-Anon as soon as you're done with the steps, if you like. But I finished the steps, but didn't make it back to Al-Anon for probably another 10 years or so. And I came back into Al-Anon at the group, which is now my home group, which is the West Seattle AFG, Saturday morning, 8:30 a.m., at the West Seattle Admiral Congregational Church. If you ever are looking for an Al-Anon meeting and you want one where the solution is the primary message of the group, that's a really awesome choice, in my opinion. And, we always recommend you try 6 meetings and see if it's for you, too. But I settled into that group, and I've been going regularly ever since. Full disclosure, I have worked the steps a number of times. I worked the steps, like I had an AA sponsor, like I mentioned, for 24 years, who was very well versed in codependency and Al-Anon issues. She was a member of Al-Anon, member of a lot of other different programs as well, as am I. And I worked the steps with that focus. And to this day, I don't have an official Al-Anon sponsor. So full disclosure, I use my AA sponsor, which is a kind of an all-around sponsor for me, and everything that I talk about in those meetings with them is all encompassing of the kind of the whole picture of my recovery. So I'm not adverse to that. I think it would probably benefit me to have a more dedicated Al-Anon sponsor at some point, and I really kind of would like to do that. Would like to do that at some point. So what I want to talk about today is kind of like, not kind of like, I want to talk about my experience of powerlessness, specifically around my Al-Anon issues. Alcoholism in my family, it's kind of like finding Waldo in the picture. I can't say that I have really obvious acting out with alcohol in my immediate family of origin. However, extended family, absolutely. We've had motor vehicle deaths as a result of alcohol. We've had a lot of different, just really crappy family gatherings as a result of extended family overuse of alcohol. But what I want to say in terms of my qualification for Al-Anon is that there is a huge component in my family of mental illness, really severe mental illness. And so all of those threads are pretty interestingly woven together, and sometimes it's really hard to kind of tease them out. But when I say mental illness, I'm not saying, like, you know, all my family, they're so crazy. You know, I mean, it's not like that. It's like there's a comedian actually out there who says, you know, my family is like, Your Honor, we find the defendant is not guilty by reason of insanity, kind of diagnosed mental illness. So for me, Al-Anon was incredibly helpful for me to understand that there was a part of what I was doing to contribute to all of the unmanageability of my life, and then there was a part that was not mine, you know, that I was indeed just garden variety Al-Anon in denial of the fact that I am powerless over people, places, and things. That the only person that I have control over or any even influence around is myself. I love the analogy in Al-Anon of the hula hoop. You know, it's like, that's it. that's, you know, I could tell you that using those words right now, right here, but the actual application of that and the, whether or not I act like that is a day at a time thing for me. But I can tell you that I act a lot more like that today than I did decades ago when I first started doing this work. So, so talking about, you know, powerlessness and unmanageability, there were, there were quite a few examples of my inability to separate out the way that I kind of like the part about like where I ended and the alcoholic began. Now, this applies to like other addictions as well. That I have a really difficult time actually determining like when I'm dealing with an addiction. Like what some of my first my first inclinations are to like just minimize, you know, and to just kind of say, oh, you know, or to actually in specifically say, you know, like deny the fact like that didn't happen. You know, that person didn't just completely lose their shit around me, you know. Excuse my I'm gonna try not to do that. So coming to terms with the fact that my life was unmanageable on a regular basis because I continually believed that I could control other people, that something I did was going to make a difference in the way that they reacted to their life and their world around them. And that was like, it was completely revolutionary to me when I heard it in an Al-Anon meeting that I didn't have any control. And that this whole thing, this whole program, was all about finding a power greater than myself that could help me with that, the absolute loss of control. So I think it's interesting that Al-Anon did not, in the first step, say we admitted we were powerless over the alcoholic. They kept it just the way, they kept that first step just the way it was. And I think there's a really good reason for that. Because it's important for me to separate out the substance or the behavior from the human being that is suffering from that addiction or alcoholism. And that even, you know, being a double winner, that applies to me too. That I have this relationship with myself as well, that there are times when I feel a sense of unmanageability and powerlessness. And it's because of my disease. I mean, the solution's always the same. But it's helpful for me to kind of like get that objective kind of detachment from myself as well as other people in my life. So as far as qualifications for Al-Anon, I mean, it's just, for me, it's like, I don't think there's a human being on this planet who doesn't qualify for Al-Anon. It's plainly stated, you know, there the problem of alcoholism in a family member, a friend, or a loved one. I can't remember exactly how it says. Let's see. It says, here, we'll go to it. Oh, it's in the traditions. What am I thinking? Yeah. So, there we go. Relatives, where it is. Got to be tradition 3, right? Let's see. We gathered together for mutual aid, call themselves. The only requirement for membership is that there be a problem of alcoholism in a relative or friend. So, that was it. It's very simple. Most everyone in my life is an alcoholic or an addict today. That includes all of you. And so how I relate to all of you becomes really what my life is about one day at a time. And I think it took me a while to kind of fall into that, to realize that that was a huge part of my qualification for Al-Anon. And it still is today. It's the one that's most important, really, because it's the one that's ongoing. It's the one that I continue to have to apply every day. in my sponsor relationships, being a sponsor and with my sponsees. I have to continually remind myself that this is a suffering human, and I am another suffering human trying to help that suffering human. You know, it's kind of like we're kind of like the inmates running the asylum in this program, right? So that brings me to the first tradition and the second tradition, actually, which is that our common welfare needs to come first. And that it says in Al-Anon, recovery for the greatest number, I think it's the way that the second tradition says it, for a group purpose, but one, oh no, sorry, first tradition, personal progress for the greatest number depends upon unity. And that the prevailing tradition of unity makes it possible for the inmates to run the asylum, you know? And that's the amazing, like, it's like a spiritual awakening right in the first step in the first tradition for me. And it really didn't even occur to me how amazing that was, honestly, until the last few years of getting deeper and deeper into the traditions by studying them and also by getting involved in service. Like deeper involved in service, like getting to, for me specifically in AA, the district level of service. It's hard for me to separate out my program, so apologize if I'm kind of like not being singleness of purpose with Al-Anon and what I share. It's kind of a blend for me. So this whole sense of unity as being the most guiding and kind of binding principle that kind of keeps us all moving in the right direction, even when stuff happens, even when we get off the path, I get off the path. Always having that motivation to come back to the path, because if I don't, I'm sabotaging my own safe space. You know, I'm sabotaging my container. It's like important for me to keep my container as clean as possible. It's like it's really, really important. And the first tradition reminds me to do that. And then the second tradition, where it talks about having a loving higher power, God, however you want to say it, as our one authority, and using the group conscience to do that. I love the fact that none of us are in charge in these 12-step programs. None of us. I've heard it said, and I believe this to be true, that I'm really grateful that usually the people in my life that are closest to me for support, it's like usually there's not more than one of us who's going totally insane on a given day. You know, we usually kind of trade off and take turns, right? So at times in my life, I've been really, really attached. You know, we talked about detachment in the meeting last night, and like what kind of like that someone mentioned, I think it was Jim last night, who mentioned, you know, the opposite of detachment is not attachment, but it's like enmeshment. You know, I've been really, really enmeshed in certain relationships over the course of my sobriety and also over the course of my time before that. And there have been, yeah, this is one of my qualifications, there have been relationships in my sobriety that have been really, in my recovery from codependency, that have been really, really unhealthy for me for like almost 10 years. Same person. Going back. Expecting things to be different. Going back. Now, if I just kind of morph myself in a different way, if I just try and find a way, find those right words. I used to think of it like a, you know, like a key in a lock. I have to find the right key so that the tumblers click, 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 and poof, fall. And then they'll understand. Yeah. They never understood, you know? It's like, and I'm here to tell you, as a, you know, to qualify myself, that I have pursued that kind of unhealthiness in relationships for years at a time. Still working my program, still going to meetings, still working the steps. It's like, it's my experience. What's also my experience is that every time that it's happened, the next time, it's shorter. It's a much shorter distance between me and freedom, me and breaking out and being able to break those bondages of unhealthy relationships. And now I stand in front of you today, and I really do, I do attribute it to the steps. I've been through the steps. In the last year, I went through 4 through 7 twice. So I got to 8, and I'm like, my sponsor and I were like, oh, you're back at 4, you know what I mean? So it's like back to 4, and then all the way through to the end. And again, I have found an amazing new level of freedom. Like, I had an opportunity to get into another one of those really, I mean, it's like they're very easy to recognize for me now. Number one, the person is usually unavailable, right? Emotionally, romantically, you name it, they're unavailable. And I know that, like, neck up, know that. But the rest of me is talking a lot of other different conversations, if you know what I mean. And this last go around, I was amazed that what has in the past taken me almost 10 years to untangle myself from was done in like 2 months. And today I stand before you really without any of those. I mean, like, it's kind of like I found this, like, you know, in terms of like what the promises the other programs say, and I'll be reading the promises from our program, this the Al-Anon program later, but it's like a new freedom and a new happiness, like literally freedom from that. Like, I stand before you today feeling a sense of not being encumbered by a relationship with an unavailable person. Part of my powerlessness was also that I would have a different relationship with you than you were having with me. And there's a certain amount of that that's just part of the human experience of being in relationship to one another. There's a certain part of that that is a great kind of proving ground and opportunity for intimacy between human beings, that you kind of find a place to meet on common ground and to really be vulnerable with one another and to express fully who you are and where you are. And then there's this huge gap of what my experience used to be, which was, I'm having a completely different relationship with you. Yeah? Again, another example of the way that I used to really act out in my Al-Anon issues. And I would find all kinds of ways to justify that. I would find all kinds of ways to just kind of make that acceptable. Or to like manipulate that other person when I really wasn't manipulating anybody or anything. It's just an illusion. And then just try and create this like make-believe relationship, which totally goes back to what I couldn't change in my family of origin. I grew up I mentioned some severe mental illness and that sort of thing. I grew up, my parents were, my dad is a World War II, decorated veteran from World War II. He was in the Battle of the Bulge, and then he finished, that was the last battle of the war, and then he moved into his service, tour of duty in Germany, freeing the concentration camps in Germany. And he was also a very, very, he was a very well-studied and well-trained. He went to an advanced accelerated high school in New York City. So he studied German during his high school years. So he was basically pretty close to fluent in German. So he was used strategically by the U.S. Army to interact with prisoners who had now just become freed. And he suffered, he still suffers to this day, from severe PTSD. And they used to call it shell shock then. You never talked about it. He never talked about it until he was over 85 years old. In the last 5 years, he's begun to deal with that. And that's only because he had a severe breakdown where he was catatonic. I shared about this a little bit in a meeting this weekend, but he was speaking three different languages at the same time, and German, Italian, and English. And even if you spoke all three of those languages, he wasn't saying anything. And it took him about 3 months and an amazing team at the geriatric PTSD team at the VA in Canandaigua, New York, to actually just get him back to us to the point where he's functional enough to have conversations with us again. But he had the what they call the startle response from PTSD. From a lot of soldiers and warriors have this. It's like if you kind of came up behind him or if he didn't hear you. He was also pretty hearing impaired, hearing deficit from all the mortar fire. And he would jump. I mean, he would like jump to the point where you had to get out of the way. And he would have horrible nightmares, some of which would end up resulting in him injuring my mother in bed. As a result, I believe, of a lot of the trauma that he had already experienced in his early childhood from a very abusive father, he transmitted a lot of that abuse onto us. And specifically, a lot of it fell on my sister in the form of a sexual transgression. So a lot of pain, you know? A lot of real, just crappy stuff. I'm not unique. I'm not unusual. I've been around these rooms long enough to know that. And yet it helps me to understand some of the like the causes and conditions as to where did this thing come from for Joe. My mom, just sweet lady, incredibly codependent, and also as far as, you know, some of the histories of any chemical addiction or alcoholism in my family, she had a tendency to go to the Vicodin, you know, and the Valium. And I remember one day going up, she asked me to get something out of her nightstand drawer. And I was already actually in the program by that time, so I'm like, it's just like an innocent kind of collision of being asked to do something. I pulled open the drawer, and this prescription bottle kind of rolled up, and it was, poof, the label of it was Valium. And I'm going to tell you guys, this was not a small prescription bottle. This was the, you know, extra strength, like this big around prescription bottle. So, I mean, it's kind of like it was a really good explanation also. And the reason why I go back and look at these things is really just to kind of like recognize in many ways how this stuff kind of got started for me. It doesn't change anything. The only thing that's going to change is my working the steps to try and find a power greater than myself that can help me get through whatever the way that this shows up again for me is. So, second step, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I got that when I heard that, when I first heard that. I was like, a lot of people think, "Oh, I wasn't insane. Now you're calling me insane." Yeah. I got that. I think that was one of the ways that I was in. You know, that was one of my like, yeah, I'm in. because not only had I seen it in my family, I also went to college to get a degree to fix my family. I have a degree in psychology, of course. And the whole motivation behind that was I originally was going to become a psychiatrist because I knew I would need to have the ability to prescribe medication, of course, because they were that sick. And unfortunately, my alcoholism and drug addiction kind of got in the way, and I really couldn't pull the grades that I needed to get to get through the pre-med piece of it. So I'm like, okay, next best thing. Let's go for psych, you know? So that in and of itself, I didn't realize that was crazy at the time, right? I thought that made perfect sense to me. You know? And but the one thing I knew is I knew that I came from a real nut house, you know? There was often lots of the way that I can describe it is really almost in terms of like, I don't want to sound too woo, but it was like energies, you know? Like people were in their own corners. Everybody in my family of origin kind of pretty much went to their corners and stayed in their corners until it was time that they were either just so pent up and sick and tired of being trapped in those corners that they lashed out, or they were lashed out at someone else who had come out of one of their corners. There was just a real sense of like, no one's talking to anyone. And this is the way that I experienced it as a real young person. It's like, nobody's talking to one another here. The only way that we knew how to communicate with one another was basically with these crazy, insane emotional outbursts, you know? That's why I say I'm Italian. I'm like second and a half generation. Some of my grandparents actually immigrated from Italy, but some of them were born here, and then my grandparents barely popped out just after that. But I was raised by a pack of wild Italian wolves, you know, I mean, as well, from New York, nonetheless, right? So that was kind of like my experience. There was a lot of yelling, which sometimes led to physical violence. A lot of times it wasn't often violence like hand-to-hand combat, but it was like I heard somebody describe inanimate object kind of violent stuff. So anyway, the whole second step made perfect sense to me is what I'm trying to say. I want to say what is really apparent to me today is how difficult it is to live with the disease of alcoholism. And I think I have a tendency to minimize that still. That it's a painful disease to be around. It's not only a painful disease that I have, but it's also a painful disease just to be around. And the after effects and the aftermath of it. And it's really important for me to stop long enough, like especially when I'm dealing with a difficult situation with somebody who, in my observation, would be in their disease. You know, that could be anybody in recovery, that could be my family, is to just stop long enough to take the time to try and put myself in their shoes. And a lot of times that means I have to practice restraint of pen and tongue, or I will regret what I did or said. And it helps me a lot to realize that I'm doing that because they're sick. I'm not doing that because I'm so noble and pious. And to stop long enough to use tools like say the Serenity Prayer really quick, run the situation through the steps all the way to, you know, God help. I can't handle this. And do an about face and do what I call radical self-care. That's one of the things that I often just completely forget. Like, the solution is for me to take care of myself. As selfish and crazy as that sounds, the solution is for me to stop what I'm doing and practice radical self-care. And it's like it's fair game. I get to decide whatever that looks like, you know. Make it the healthiest I can possibly make it in that moment, and I get to make that decision. And I don't owe anybody an explanation for it, although oftentimes I do give one. But I have to remember, I don't owe that. Because I learned very early on that I somehow had to justify. I had to justify my right to be sucking air in a room. I don't have to do that. Oh, I made a couple notes too. Let's see. Anyway, heck with that. So as I kind of move through the steps, it's important for me to remember that third step is just really about making a decision, and then I have to like follow that with writing a fourth step. I mean, there's just no way that it works any other way. And that it is just making a decision. Like, I love the three frogs on a log analogy. If you guys have ever heard it, it's like, you know, there's three frogs on a log. You know, one of them makes a decision to jump off the log. How many frogs are on the log? Still three, you know? And the course of vigorous action has to be like really right in line, or I'm just going to be miserable. And as my previous sponsor used to say, how well do you want to get, Joe? And what are you willing to do about it? And I hated hearing that. I didn't want that to be what I was going to have to do for the rest of my life every time I felt miserable. But it works, and it works really well. Fourth step, searching a fearless moral inventory. I'm a gay man. Using the word moral around me was a dangerous thing for you. never liked the word. Always remembered the term, you know, the moral majority, who is neither, you know. And it took me decades to understand the word moral in the fourth step the way I understand it today. And it's more of the same thing about what I'm talking about. It's this sense of what works for Joe. And I'm a traditionalist when it comes to fourth step inventories. I have actually written out most of the Blueprint for Progress and lost momentum in that experience, in that process. But I have come back to the traditional form of the columns from the AA Big Book. And I know a lot of people in Al-Anon who also use that as well. But the whole second column is like, you know, we asked ourselves why we were angry. It's like, nobody ever asked me that. It's like, everybody always, I used to get like, why did you do that a lot, you know? I mean, like, what were you thinking? Got that a lot. But I never got like, why are you angry? And so it was a completely revolutionary and novel experience for me to actually ask myself that question, or to have a sponsor working with me to say, why are you angry? And my first sponsor used to put, because it's in the text of that the narrative of that section of the book where it says, angry, hurt, or threatened. And I asked myself that question, you know, where am I angry, hurt, or threatened in this relationship with this institution, this person, institution, or principle? And I start to come to a sense of what is morally within Joe's code. Like, what's Joe's code? I'm still working on that. I still get to learn stuff about that all the time. But, like, what's in Joe's code? Like, how's this working for me? When I look at, and in my work in inventory lately, it's become even deeper than some of the things in the next column, which are, you know, how does it affect my personal relationships, including sex, my pocketbook, my security, my ambitions. It's gone kind of beyond, I'm missing one, but it's like, it's gone beyond that for me to really be able to dig down deeper into what the whole purpose of that process is to see what is not working for me anymore. And to see that I need to have a different set of values in order for my life to work better. And there's always room for improvement. And there's always discoveries. So the discoveries that are most frequently found in the inventory work that I do are, I am incredibly fearful. You know, the fear inventory is also really helpful for me, like on that. You know, where you don't have a resentment and connection with it, it's like, oh, man, I thought I was safe, you know, and then they, like, come up with that, oh, man, even though you don't have a resentment and connection with it, I'm like, dang. Free-floating fear. Fear of the unknown. That which I can't control, you know, fear of things that I can't control. But what usually comes up in addition to that is I'm incredibly judgmental. You know, it's like there's one thing that qualifies me for Al-Anon. it's like that's where I need to focus my efforts and my work with a power greater than myself. I also have big security issues. You know, I'm incredibly insecure. Gotten better, a lot better. At least to the point where I don't believe that voice in my head that's just so incredibly fearful, insecure, and judgmental. It's kind of like, really? We're going there again? Like, that's different. That's progress, right? It's like, you have to keep on looking for the progress. And so off into the sixth and seventh step I go. I'm sure, like, well, fifth step is awesome because fifth step is just, for me, this wonderful opportunity to not only get another human being's input on it, but to actually take the time to, like, see how this is working in the grand scheme of my relationship with a power greater than myself. How much have I blocked myself off from all these amazing experiences of being connected to my fellows, being connected to the earth? I'm a big, big proponent of nature as a power greater than myself. I love backpacking. I love hiking. I love getting out into the outdoors. It's always there. It's the thing. It's like I used to go to a church that said, there is no place where God is not. And that made a lot of sense to me. It's always there. And it's always in the present moment. And that is when I'm really connecting with another human being and being vulnerable with another human being to tell them, this is how I screwed up. Or this is what I think of myself. This is what my mind tells me. This is who my mind tells me I am. Dangerous place to go, you know? But I need to go there with another human being, because if I keep that stuff inside of here, it's bad. It gets really, really ugly and rotten, stinky up there. So the fifth step allows me to really kind of get that into a different context. And having another person give me feedback on that makes it look completely different. And I get to see it from a different angle. I've never gone through a fifth step, whether I'm giving one or receiving one, where we don't both come out the other side with, like, wow, that was interesting. Where did that come from? It's the way this stuff works. Specifically, I think after the desire to drink and use went away, the focus of every one of my fourth and fifth steps was my inability, my powerlessness over people, places, and things. So, six and seven, you know, it's like my first few times through that were, through those steps were, surface. See, it's like I heard a lot of people say, well, there's only one paragraph or two paragraphs in the book, which I can't remember exactly how many there are, but it's very short, very little said in the actual text of Alcoholics Anonymous about the six and seven step. There's a lot in the 12 and 12, actually, which is often overlooked. A lot of great stuff. There's a lot of stuff in Al-Anon literature about the six and seven step. It's great stuff. But the first few times, I didn't really want to know that, you know. I didn't know that I didn't want to know that at the time. I just thought, oh, wow, pass, check. This last time through, two times through, 6 and 7, I knew I needed more help. I knew I needed more understanding about how these things were undoing me. Thank you. So I actually went into some outside literature, which is written by inside people, and I got a lot out of that. If you're ever interested in knowing what that is, just let me know after the meeting, and I can talk to you about that book. It really helped me to dig a lot deeper into the wholeness of my recovery. The 12th step says that we practice these principles in all our affairs. That's a really tall order, right? I mean, it's just like in the third step where it says that, you know, we made a decision to turn our life and our will over to the care of God as we understood him. You know, it's like, no problem, right? It's like when when that landed, it freaked me out. It was like, because I don't think I probably the first time I did it, that really didn't land. And I would have probably been totally petrified to go on to the fourth through the ninth steps, right? If it really landed. But thank God, I mean, that's the beauty of the fog in the beginning, right? What is my will? Like, you know, I've heard it described a lot of different ways, my thoughts and my actions, all those different things. It's like, but that in addition to like the end of the steps where it says, you know, we sought to practice these principles in all our affairs. How do I do that? You know? It's like today, I mean, the biggest things that I think of are my friends, my relationships with my friends, specifically most of my recovery friends, my family, and work. Those are the big kind of proving grounds. You know, those are my three greatest classrooms. And it's important for me to know that I'm doing my best to work with a power greater than myself in those three classrooms, in those projects, so to speak. It's like on a daily basis. So some days I wake up and I just like hit the ground running. You know, it's like I have this unique, and I'm not sure if it's a great thing yet because it's only been going on for a few months, but I get to work like hybrid. I basically get to work either from home or going to an office. It's like I get to kind of choose. And some mornings I literally roll out of bed at 7:55 and into the next room, into my home office, in front of 2 17-inch monitors, and there we go. Game on. Some days I don't do that, you know. And some days, even when I do that, I stop, and I go into the living room, and I sit down for 15 minutes and meditate. And, you know, those days are a lot better. A lot, lot better. They're a lot easier on me, and honestly, they are so much easier on the people that I work with and the people that I live with and have relationships with. So, continuing to ask God to remove my shortcomings, even if I'm not aware of them, on that day. Like, help me to work on what I can see, and help me to work on also what I am not able to see yet. And just make the bottom line be that I treat people with respect and kindness. So, 8th and 9th step. I did a lot of amends in my first run through the steps in AA, like a lot of the cleaning up amends, as we call them. It was like I was a petty thief, you know? I thought it was more important to actually steal my food so I had more money to spend on drugs, you know? Still had to eat. I'm Italian, after all, you know? It's like, but I would go into these grocery stores and I would literally just stuff my jacket with food. And it's just so unattractive today, you know, when I think about it, right? It's like, it's a little waif, you know, stuffing his long hair and, you know, just. And I got arrested for that. I got arrested once. I was caught more than once. And so, you know, the kind of like the nickel and the dollars and cents amends, you know, of going back to those places and literally with a check in hand and, you know, just with an estimate, and then if that was enough, and talking to those folks. Then it was the amends that I had to make to, thanks, Bob, to my family members. I was kind of a bomb dropper in my family. I was kind of a bomb dropper. Came home, New York, I was living in Colorado at the time. This is before I got sober. Came home, came out to them. Yeah, came out of the closet. It's like, surprise, you know, and hey, I'm home. And then it's like, shortly after that, I wasn't sure if I had contracted HIV. And so I was in this waiting period. So I chose to go home and tell my parents that, you know. Whoops, wouldn't do that again. I mean, you had to wait 6 months in those days. I mean, that was like the mid-80s. It wasn't these like special quickie tests that you can get now. Then the next year I went home and about a year later than that, I went back and came out to them about being an alcoholic. Like before I had worked the steps or anything, you know, like it was just like, hey, and by the way, I'm an alcoholic, you know. I don't know that I would do that the same way again. It was pretty unkind to my parents, you know. I kind of beat them up with the truth. You know, they talk about being rigorously honest in this program, but it's like I was, you know, like abusively honest. I felt the need to somehow puke my truth on you. And I did that with my family. And I needed to make amends for all that. I needed to make amends for stealing from them. I needed to make amends for the fact that I got a DUI before I even had a driver's license. And we had to drag them back from vacation to come bail me out of jail. Oops, you know? All those things that I needed to make amends for. And today, still, what I do is I do my best to be a good son, a good brother, a good uncle, and to the best of my ability, show up. And I'm telling you, in my family, that's not the easiest thing to do. Because they quite often really would rather, I think, not have Joe, the recovering Joe, around. Kind of like a reminder for them of the contrast is just a little too much sometimes. So I try to be considerate, not confrontatory, kind, loving, do my best. And I think it works pretty well, generally. My sister, that's another story. I've done my best with her, and I just realized I can't have a relationship with her right now, day at a time. I tried every possible application of the principles, and they fell short of being able to be engaged in a relationship. I've heard it said that, and I don't know if, I'm really not sure if I agree with this yet or not, or else I just don't want to know it if it's true, is that your connection, your relationship with your higher power can only be as good as your most problematic relationship in your life. And I'm like, ah, that's not good. Yeah. But I tell you what that's done for me is it's renewed my commitment to work on my side of that difficult relationship. So it works. 10, 11, and 12. I love 10, 11, and 12. Prayer and meditation, connecting with a power greater than myself and asking for the knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry that out can make a whole completely different experience of what I thought was supposed to happen or what I thought was going to happen and what I was, most importantly, what I was afraid was going to happen. Most of that stuff never happens unless I create it, unless I jump in and I make a mess of what really would have just been kind of a moderate mess, you know? I know I'm running short on time, so what I want to do is I want to just talk briefly about the 12th step and how Al-Anon helps me to be a better sponsor in all the programs I'm a member of. I currently am an active member. I'm a member of AA, of Al-Anon, and of SAA, Sex Addicts Anonymous. I've been in that program and sober for 26 years. Thank you. And I do a lot of service work. And the 12-step teaches me every day how to be more effective in service. And and most importantly, it teaches me to get out of the way of being more effective in service. Like this isn't my deal. I go back to the second tradition. It's like, I just need to be part of a group conscience. I just need to be part of the group. If I'm asked to lead, like I was asked to share here this weekend, I try not to say no. I learned that early on, even though it's scary sometimes. I've shared my story like 3 times in the last month and a half. It's like, it can be kind of rigorous after a while, but I don't argue it. It's just like, honestly, I sometimes don't know why you people want to hear me. There's that insecurity again, right? But it's not mine to tell. It's not mine to say why you all want it, why I'm asked, or whatever. You know, I mean, it's Jim's way of getting me here after years of trying to talk me into it on my own will. So what I want to do is I want to wrap up. I just want to say I had a conversation with a sponsee yesterday, and I honestly do think that she's using. I'm not sure of that at all, but I had a conversation over in that building over there, and I was so grateful for my Al-Anon program as I was having that conversation. I just really wanted to be supportive of her. I love her. We worked the steps together. She drifted away from the program. Other things became more important. She's dealing with an alcoholic husband. I've invited her to Al-Anon more times than I care to, more times than I probably should have. She's got to have her own experience of this thing, and I don't know what that's supposed to be. So I'm going to close with reading you the promises, the Al-Anon promises. Here, I'm going to do it from a different screen here. And they're a little long, so bear with me. If we willingly surrender ourselves to the spiritual discipline of the 12 steps, our lives will be transformed. We will become mature, responsible individuals with a great capacity for joy, fulfillment, and wonder. Though we may never be perfect, continued spiritual progress will reveal to us our enormous potential. We will discover that we are both worthy of love and loving. We will love others without losing ourselves, and we'll learn to accept love in return. Our sight, once clouded and confused, will clear, and we will be able to perceive reality and recognize truth. Courage and fellowship will replace fear. We will be able to risk failure to develop new hidden talents. Our lives, no matter how battered and degraded, will yield hope to share with others. We will begin to feel and will come to know the vastness of our emotions, but we will not be slaves to them. Our secrets will no longer bind us in shame. As we gain the ability to forgive ourselves, our families, and the world, our choices will expand. With dignity, we stand for ourselves, but not against our fellows. Serenity and peace will have meaning for us as we allow our lives and the lives of those we love to flow day by day with God's ease, balance, and grace. No longer terrified, we will discover we are free to delight in life's paradox, mystery, and awe. We will laugh more. Fear will be replaced by faith, and gratitude will come naturally as we realize that our higher power is doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves. Can we really grow to such proportions? Only if we accept life as a continuing process of maturation and evolution toward wholeness. Then we suddenly begin to notice these gifts appearing. We see them in those who walk beside us. Sometimes slowly and haltingly, occasionally in great bursts of brilliance, Those who work the steps change and grow toward light, toward health, and toward their higher power. Watching others, we realize this is also possible for us. Will we ever arrive? Feel joyful at the time, all the time? Have no cruelty, tragedy, or injustice to face? Probably not, but we will acquire growing acceptance of our human fallibility as well as greater love and tolerance for each other. Self-pity, resentment, martyrdom, rage, and depression will fade into memory. Community, rather than loneliness, will define our, community, rather than loneliness, will define our lives. We will know that we belong, we are welcome, we have something to contribute, and that is enough. Thanks for having me share.